Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Join Finance okays $102 million for four county-run juivenile prisons, but balks at Governor Evers' request for two state facilities. Tough-on-crime bills trigger emotional debate in the Assembly.
Violent crime went up 47%.
Y'all making it seem as if everybody is, this is just violent criminals all around.
Up to 81,000 absentee voters won't be mailed two ballots. The Elections Commission decides. Primary voters Tuesday will pick two candidates for the April 7 election for a 10-year term on the state Supreme Court. And yes, Wis Politics stock picks. All this in the February 14 edition of Rewind, your week in review.
I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
A lot happened in these final weeks of the session, a lot to cover. But let's start with the announcement today by Republican leaders, their tax cuts. So let's just walk through what they just announced, and then I'll give you a chance to elaborate on it. $250 million in tax year 2020, income tax reduction through higher deductions. They said the average income tax payer, I assume that's the one that does owe money, $105, $100 million to pay down long-term debt, $45 million cut in personal property taxes that businesses pay on machinery and tools. I didn't see any huge surprises. How about you?
No. The talk I've been hearing for the last kind of week has been that in the Senate Republican caucus, there is kind of a hodgepodge of ideas about taxes. So they would get on the same page, essentially, and get something they could all agree on. This is a nod toward personal property taxes, a big deal for some Senate Republicans. This gets at that. Also, Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, I spoke with him earlier this week. He said they want to do something to help businesses because it's really corporate taxes driving this kind of surplus that we're seeing. So you get something back to the business community. So that's basically what you're seeing. It's kind of like a little bit for everybody. The issue is there's nothing in it for Governor Evers from what he wants.
That's where I was going to go next. He wanted $251 million in higher K-12 school aids. Excuse me.
Yes, but of that $251 million, or $252, you know, in change.
$251.9.
$130 would go toward basically school aids that would drive down property taxes. So you have this cap on spending per student. It's a mix of state aid and property taxes. The more state aid you have in that formula, the less you need for property taxes. So Evers' plan included a property tax cut in it. Republicans said, no, we're going to go this route. Interesting. Evers didn't talk to Republicans before he did his idea. They didn't talk to him before they did their idea.
Right.
Why am I bringing that up? Because we have a week left before the Assembly is done or says it's going to be done. This will be done either next week or by the Senate come March. I'm trying to figure out, will Evers sign this thing between now and whenever it's done? Also, because if Evers doesn't sign it, he would have this money still sitting there in the general fund come next budget. What's that mean? Evers can then put the money toward education in the next budget, you know, spend it then. I mean, Republicans may take it out, but he have to play with. Two, if Evers does veto that package, Republicans say, hey, this is the difference between us and Democrats. We have excess money. We want to give it back to you guys. They want to spend it and grow government. So,
and for that reason, I have real doubts whether he could veto this package.
I don't.
You don't?
No. I think.
Okay.
I think he definitely could veto it.
Well, okay. It was interesting to me. The press conference this morning, three Assembly Republicans. But immediately, Scott Fitzgerald, the majority leader of the Senate, put out a press release saying, I like this plan.
Mm-hmm.
So it tells me, as Representative Ballwig said, that the Senate is on board with this. The Assembly is scheduled to pass it next week. But as you said, the biggest question is, would the governor sign it into law? Democrats vote against this?
That might be your first sign. How do Democratic lawmakers react to this on the floor? If you have an overwhelming bipartisan vote, that's a different story, right?
Yeah.
If you have a party line vote, then yeah, I can see the governor vetoing this.
Okay, and that just happened just today. Okay, now let's go back to a controversy that began, as we noted, 2 years ago, closing Lincoln Hills, the juvenile prisons, and then they had a plan 2 years ago, remember?
Yes.
Fast forward this week. Joint Finance approved $102 million for four county-run prisons, Brown, Dane, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. That was step one of what got approved. What didn't get approved is the governor's proposal for two what do they call them? Type 1?
Type 1 facilities for the most serious offenders.
For the most serious offenders, run by the state. The governor had proposed putting one in Milwaukee and the other in the town of Hortonia, which is
Outagamie County.
Thank you. Well, finance funds the four counties, does not fund, as we're about to hear from Representative Taylor, the two state facilities. And the bottom line, as Correction Secretary Carr said, is this will keep open Lincoln Hills past the July 1, 2021 deadline, correct?
Yes, and joint finance funded, but didn't fully fund the county facilities. There's still a step to go to the building commission.
There's big overruns on these things.
They're basically telling the building commission, go find the rest of the money and what you already have laying around to finish off the four. Let's take a step back and look at what happened 2 years ago. There were problems in Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, which are in northern Wisconsin, major problems.
Major.
There was a federal investigation into how the teenagers up were being treated by staff. It resulted in no criminal charges being filed.
Millions being paid on behalf of, anyway, go ahead.
There's a political issue. And so looking ahead to the fall election and knowing there's going to be a problem, Republicans pushed together this bill with the help of Democrats to close Lincoln Hills with a set of deadline and propose $80 million to fund everything. And talking to people back 2 years ago, they knew from day one that was not going to be enough. They basically pulled a number, a guess of a number in this package as a placeholder, saying, we'll come back and fix it later on. We'll address the cost. Now we're seeing the price tag, what it really costs to do four county facilities and two type one facilities. It's not $80 million. Now, Republicans are blaming Evers for not doing a better job of communicating to local officials about where these things might go. Democrats are blaming Republicans for basically saying you want to close Lincoln Hills, but not doing enough to close Lincoln Hills.
Yeah.
The bottom line is that they passed a flawed bill 2 years ago without a realistic price tag or a realistic pot of money in it, and now they're paying the price. That's just the bottom line.
Yeah, and there was a very sharp exchange between Representative Chris Taylor, a Democrat, and Finance Co-Chairman John Nigrens. Let's hear that.
You cannot say we are reforming our juvenile justice system and leave Lincoln Hills open and Copper Lake open. You're not reforming if you're not funding the alternative. Let's approve this plan and let's get the resources so we can truly reform juvenile corrections in the state of Wisconsin.
From your perspective, we're saying no to a perfect proposal. We've already identified the fact that there's not the funding for it. We've already now identified the fact that local units of government weren't even consulted about a facility that was going to be placed in their community. I have to say, I guess I'm a little shocked that you know, for a party that has been lecturing us for several sessions about local control, that you actually wouldn't engage the people at the local level, and yet you're okay with that today? We're not. And we're going to say, go back to the drawing board.
Next subject. Last week we talked about that there was a general agreement that was going to be formed, compromises on how to help farmers. Well, Assembly Republicans this week announced a $26 million aid package, farmers plus small businesses. So let's walk through that. $27 million of that would offset property taxes, would be a property tax credit farmers could claim on ag buildings. Point one, that credit would be capped at $7,500 for farmers who had an annual income from farm income of $35,000. Let's keep walking through in a little bit before I give J.R. a chance to talk about it. $9 million in new health care tax deductions for farmers and small businesses. Now, testimony in that Assembly Ag Committee, estimates are of that $9 million, $2.5 would go to farmers, the rest would go to small businesses. And finally, $600,000 in per year in grants to dairy processing plants that produce up to 50 million pounds of product. Before we hear from that, JR, thoughts on the package? Is this going to be acceptable to the governor?
Well, Assembly Republicans told us a week ago, they're going to go bigger and bolder than Evers. So
yes,
they have definitely put a bigger price tag on this. Now, the question is, one, what will the Senate do? I mean, that's the question on everything at this point. And why I bring that up is, it's like a broken record. The Senate has concerns about spending. The Senate has concerns about long-term debt. The Senate has concerns about structural deficit. So here you have a tax package. How does this fit in with homeless bills? So we have a tax package that we think that Fitzgerald likes, but how does this fit with the water bills, the homeless bill? I mean, there are all these things going on out there.
Yeah, the puzzle is not yet come
so
together.
So can I see a farm package getting done? Yes, I can. Okay. Can I promise you this is what it's going to look like? No, because I got to see what that caucus does. And what usually happens at caucus is, you know, 19 members, and they're all over the board. And they kind of like find somewhere that's close to balance, and Fitzgerald comes in and closes the deal and says, okay, here's our answer, we're going to get there.
Okay.
Here's a compounding factor in this whole thing, right? Fitzgerald's running for Congress right now. So how much does Scott Fitzgerald tune into like sealing the deal on these bills with his caucus versus running for Congress? Also, how does his caucus view him right now as somebody who's 1 foot out the door to a House seat versus the person they have to answer to for the next 2.5-3 years? So right. I'm not saying he can't do this. I'm just saying it's an added intrigue for insiders, like what's happening in the Senate caucus right now.
Okay, time to hear from Representative Travis Tranel, who is a farmer in southwest Wisconsin, talking about why this package is needed.
We are losing over 2 dairy farms a day, as you're well aware. We lost over 800 in calendar year 2019 alone. And we continue to lead this country in terms of farm bankruptcies. The reality is that our farmers are simply having cash flow issues. And so my goal in crafting this legislation and working with Senator Markline was try to figure out what we could do to put some dollars back in the pockets of farmers pretty much immediately. So one of the important components that we wanted when we passed this piece of legislation, or drafted this piece of legislation, I should say, was to come up with a way where we could, in essence, return dollars that farmers have already paid into the government back to them, so that we could get away from this notion that this is just another handout, this is just another form of farmer welfare. Over the last 10 years, farmers have paid over $1 billion in property taxes on these ag buildings. And what we wanted to do was take a portion of those dollars, a small portion, and get them back to them and recognize the value that those farmers are providing to our economy.
So when the governor weighs whether to sign this farm aid package, he's going to have what is the income tax cut look like? Mm-hmm. How far have they come on the clean water issues and all these other issues?
Yeah. Plus, I mean, let's be honest. Governor Evers forced the hand of Republican lawmakers by doing this announcement to State of the State back in, you know, late January. Of he had this $8.5 or $9 million package of his own.
Yeah, the GOP is tripling it. Go ahead.
Yeah, but they didn't have a plan. They didn't have a package at that time ready to roll. So when Evers did this, it kind of forced them to act. Now the question is, can the Senate get on board what the Assembly did and send them back to Evers? And whatever Evers signs is a win for him in terms of ag policy, because he was only got the ball rolling.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, new subject. We spent a lot of time last week talking about the bill that allows for the processing and testing of rape kits. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. I just want to point out that the Assembly this week did accept the three amendments, Victims' Bill of Rights, immigration, and school choice provisions. My question is, what's your read on whether the Senate is going to take the bill that, yes, funds the testing of rape kits plus these other three provisions?
Good question, because when I talked last week to some Republicans about this from the caucus, they were like, we're not big fans of these changes. They wanted a clean bill. But like anything, they have to go through this process where they meet and talk and hash it amongst themselves. So who knows where it's going to end up between now and sometime in the middle of March when they break. But I didn't get the feeling last week, at least, that there was a lot of appetite for these changes among some Republicans in the Senate.
I understand. But if they stripped off these three additional amendments and came back to the pure bill, that would force the Assembly to come back in March to approve that.
Well, Robin Voss has said over and over again they're not coming back. Now, Robin says that every session they're not coming back.
Yes, you and I have heard leaders say that. Okay. But now there was very emotional debate on the bill that would fund the testing of rape kits on the floor of the Assembly. Let's listen to a snippet of that, please.
This is not the issue that you should be playing political games with. There is a straightforward bipartisan bill that we should be taking up. A bill that truly protects survivors. The Republicans have turned their backs on victims. The Republicans had the chance to give victims peace of mind. But instead, they chose to play politics and allow hundreds of rapists walk the streets.
Victim Bill of Rights. You know, I think this was the hardest part for me because I thought that it would make sense after the trauma of being raped that maybe we could have on a piece of paper all the things that were available to somebody to make a piece of paper that we could hand a woman after she'd been raped that maybe she could refer to because maybe she was so upset that she couldn't remember it. That's awful. What were we thinking? I had a girlfriend. She was raped in her high school. She was known as the rape girl. Imagine that we want to say, if you don't want to go through the trauma of being known as that kid, as Robin, her name was Robin, that Robin was known as the rape girl in my high school, that she wanted to go to a different school, that that's a bad thing, you're right. Then vote no. The vote is green. Thank you.
The Assembly last week also acted on a package of tough-on-crime bills. Mm-hmm. They moved them to the Senate. The Senate has its own ideas. Do you think we'll see some major tough-on-crime bills on the governor's desk here within a couple months?
Possibly. Fitzgerald said he still had to work with his caucus about the biggest ticket one, about revoking parole supervision for those who commit another crime.
Yes. That's the number one priority of Representative Sanfilippo.
There is a concern that it would dramatically increase the price, the cost for Department of Corrections, with housing new offenders. Could also require the building of new prisons or expanding ones that we have. Now, Sanfilippo said he doesn't believe the cost estimate, but that's a very real figure out there of what it would cost to do this. Now, part of the dynamic I've talked about with the Senate Republican Caucus is some of those folks don't want to spend any money. But with this package, they're okay spending it because the reality is Evers is going to veto it. So it's not really going to happen. So maybe they get some of these things done, maybe they don't. But I don't see the governor signing a lot of this package. Maybe some parts, but not all of it, because he has said during the campaign he wants to reduce the prison population, look at new alternatives to sentencing, those kinds of things.
Right.
Don't forget, we're an outlier right now. The national movement is toward
45 states.
Toward things that do the opposite of this.
And the federal government. And President Trump in his State of the Union speech mentioned the fact that thousands of what had been federal inmates have been released as a result of this new federal legislation.
So you also have a lot of suburban Republican lawmakers who are making a pitch on these things. You have suburban voters who are a little bit squishy about Republicans right now because of President Trump. Maybe this is an appeal to those folks to try and show them that we're the Republicans are the law and order type party kind of thing. Maybe, but there's also movement among Republicans away from this stuff. So it's just a really interesting dynamic that it's going to be fun to watch it play out. What does Evers do with what gets to his desk, and how does this fit in what's happening nationally?
Right. In Wisconsin, I had a chance yesterday to do a civil dialogue with two leading lawmakers on this issue. As J.R. said, GOP Representative Sanfilippo, Democratic Representative Evan Goyke, a former public defender. So just the arguments, whether we should enact a more humane policy, in the words of the Democrats like Goyke, that reduces our prison population, or focus on these that are released and do some heinous crimes, it's a very interesting give and take. Please.
The bills that I've authored have nothing to do with somebody shooting and killing somebody. That I have no disagreement whatsoever that that person be held accountable and serve a period of incarceration. But sitting next to them in their prison is somebody that has been convicted of a nonviolent offense that we could better handle, treat, and supervise in the community. And so our prison resources need to be focused on those people that pose a public safety threat and not on those people that can be treated in the community.
Well, there are people who shouldn't be in jail, right? If they have addiction problems or non-serious crimes, mm-hmm. give them a second chance, create those rehabilitative programs. But the problem comes in is that our criminal justice system, in their zeal to reduce prison population and reduce jail population, is treating everybody the same. So they are letting out some very dangerous people onto our streets who shouldn't be out there. This isn't an either-or choice. This is, give us some of Evan's stuff, but give us some of our stuff too, because it seems like over the past decade, families and victims have been completely shut out of the process and totally ignored because all of the focus is on the criminals and the cost of incarceration and how do we lower the jail population.
The issue that I did not see coming a week ago when we taped this show was two potential ballots for absentee voters. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly there's a Journal Sentinel story. The Elections Commission is serious about sending A, ballots out first with the names of presidential candidates, and then B, ballots to potentially 81,000. Now, the Elections Commission, which is three D's and three R's, in a rare display of unanimity, voted not to do this. So the conflict, JR, correct me if I'm wrong, we have a law that was passed in 2011 which specifies how much time you need to send out ballots when there's federal office, and that's different from state office. And but now they won't be sent. Mm-hmm. So, but still, two ballots will be sent to those that are in the military and those Wisconsin residents who want to vote overseas. I didn't see this issue coming. Connect the dots, as our governor says for me.
So basically, our election days don't work anymore for spring elections.
Right.
And this is why. Don't forget, back in 2012, the primary for the fall primary that used to be in September was moved back to August because of overseas military voters. Federal law says you have to ship off these ballots by, I think it's 45 days before an election. Well, there wasn't enough time between the fall primary and the fall general election to do that. They moved it back. They didn't move spring election dates, however. And now, fast forward to now, we're realizing just how much a problem that is with these dates, because, yes, there are more than 45 days between the February 18th primary and the April 7th general election. However, you must certify the votes, which takes a week for the most part, right?
Right.
Print the ballots and get them shipped off. You can't do that in the window that they have. So basically what the Elections Commission has done is said, okay, look, this would be a nightmare and make us a laughingstock if we had a problem. We're going to say
coming on the heels of the Iowa Dems debacle.
We're going to say the heck with it. Just send out this one ballot. But what they've opened the door to, though, is a complaint. Like, they could get sued about this because the law is clear what you're supposed to do. They're saying we'd rather go ahead and after the fact get sued than before the fact have a possible nightmare in hands. So looking ahead, the question I have is, what will lawmakers do about this to avoid this happening down the road? It would require moving those dates. Now, here's the thing. We have traditionally had the spring election the first week of April, right? If you're going to keep that there and move back to primary, it gets closer to Christmas all the time, which means you're circulating nomination papers closer to Christmas, the holiday. I mean, there's a ripple effect. So either you're going to go back, right, with when you have the primary, or go forward with the general. Well, the more forward you go, you get into, like, spring. There are lots of things that are going to be impacted by that, but at some point, I'm hearing from people, somebody has to say, look, this doesn't work anymore. So how do we fix it?
Right. And it was interesting when you watch that Election Commission meeting, one of the Democrats, Ann Jacobs, says, this is insane. Mm-hmm. You know, we could look like Iowa. And the chairman, Dean Knutson, a former GOP lawmaker.
Helped create the Elections Commission and Ethics Commission.
Right, when you blew up the accountability board, says this law doesn't work. So it's just really interesting. But bottom line, 81,000 absentee ballots, A and B ballots, will not be sent.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. Now let's talk about interrelated development. Tuesday's the primary.
Yep.
Now let me look up the number. The last time we had a primary for the Supreme Court, 534,000 votes. As you know, the Elections Commission doesn't make predictions anymore. So let's. Why don't you give me the short recap of who's running? And we have three candidates for the Supreme Court. Dan Kelly, go.
Dan Kelly, conservative justice, he's favored to make it out. So the top two vote getters emerge going on to the April election. Kelly has had a fundraising advantage. He's up on TV. He's the favorite to finish first right now, in part because he's the only conservative of the race. And the other two, Joe Kurowski, Dane County judge, and Ed Falone, Marquette Law professor, should split the progressive vote. So, All right, so there's Kelly's got the advantage. Between Kurowski and Falone, for the most part, people I talk to think that Kurowski has an edge. She's a sitting judge. Voters in Wisconsin like a candidate for Supreme Court who's been a judge before.
Dane County base. Which almost cast, I think, in terms of the 2016 election, almost as many votes for Clinton as Milwaukee. Go ahead.
But Falone has the Milwaukee background, right? He's from Milwaukee. Block has endorsed him. He just has not raised much money. He's not up on radio or TV. The best bet for Falone might be if there's a really big turnout for the mayor's race and for county executive in Milwaukee, they can somehow ride to a second place finish. But people right now I talk to you feel like it's Kelly and Kurowski in the best position. I try to keep an open mind, not rule anything out. But look, just look at the finances. They've raised more. Kurowski's up on the air now, too. So It just gives them an advantage going into Tuesday.
Okay. And the 534,000 votes cast the last time we had a primary. Kind of meaningless, right?
Yeah, it's hard to know like what's going to. So we have a congressional, a primary up in northern Wisconsin.
Let's talk about some of the other primaries. 7th Congressional District, go ahead.
So you've got really the Republican side is where the action is. Tom Tiffany, state lawmaker for about a decade from Minocqua. Jason Church, former aide to Ron Johnson, U.S. Senator, retired Army captain who was injured in Afghanistan, double amputee. That primary has generated $2.5 million in independent expenditure report of the FEC as of this morning. I have never seen that much money spent on a primary.
$2.5 in independent?
On a primary. Now, I've seen that kind of money in a general election, right?
Right.
We're talking a primary.
But you're not talking the numbers racked up by the campaigns. You're
talking independent expenditures. That is going to be an interesting one to watch. So the Supreme Court, Milwaukee Mayor's race, Milwaukee County Zef's race. They have some local offices, you know, but those are the big four to watch.
Okay.
Come Tuesday.
Okay. Final topic before we get into your stock picks. I found it interesting that national media reported that U.S. Senator Ron Johnson asked President Trump, don't fire the European ambassador, Gordon Sondland, who had testified to the House impeachment committee. So Johnson and three other GOP senators urged the president to not fire him. He was one, as I said, three of several witnesses who testified to the U.S. House Committee on Impeachment. Johnson chairs, he has a key role. He chairs the Europe Subcommittee on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's a member of the Senate Ukraine Caucus. His statement, Mr. Sondland was pretty resigned. He was going to be leaving the post anyway. It would have been nice to give him the ability to exit on his own terms and his own time in a few weeks. Any PS on this?
No, it's just a quick one for critics. It's just fodder to say, look, Republican senators, you didn't hold Trump accountable with the impeachment trial. This is what's happening. You can't rein him in. He's going to do what he wants. What are you going to do to stop him in the future or to influence him in the future? Can you do anything to influence him in the future?
Right. Okay. Two-minute drill on your stock picks.
All right, so rising, 7th CD congressional spending. Again, we mentioned $2.5 million independent expenditures. Those are the ads that say vote for, vote against, those kinds of things, the magic words we call them. Look at the FEC filings. I have never seen this kind of spending on a primary for a House seat from Wisconsin. I went back and looked. 2012, Mark Pocan and Kelda Royce ran in a Democratic primary for the 2nd congressional district. There were none. I think there were $6,000 roughly in 2014. The 6th congressional district with a three-way GOP primary in 2016 with Mike Gallagher and Frank LaSalle, Republican primary, like $50,000. That gives you the context of what's happening here. Now, the dynamic of that race, what I've talked about for weeks, Tom Tiffany is a known quantity up there. Does that help him ride to the GOP nomination? Or is Jason Church, in this interesting profile, as an outsider, Army veteran, the double amputee, is that story compelling enough to get him to the primary? And both guys trying to wrap themselves with Donald Trump because it is Trump territory for sure up there.
Mixed.
Dan Kopanky, former state senator, hoping third time's a charm.
Cross.
Yep. He lost his Senate seat to Jennifer Schilling in 2011 in a recall election. He lost a rematch with her in 2016, but by 61 votes. He's back for a third time. Now, that seat has been traditionally pretty Democratic, but in 2016, Hillary Clinton got 48% of the vote in that district versus Trump's 44 and change. That's what helped Kopanky make it a close race. He's got appeal, bipartisan appeal, because he's longtime owner of La Crosse Loggers, which is a summer college baseball team in La Crosse. He's well known from his days in the state Senate. He has some appeal, but he needs more than that. He needs to have a close race top ticket again, because you have numbers like Barack Obama in 2012, won 57%, that's a much tougher hill for him to climb. Also, Kopanky has some baggage. He ran for Congress in 2010 against Ron Kind and lost. During that race came up that he had an ethics violation for using money from a private foundation to pay for lights at that Logger Stadium. He repaid the money, but that kind of dinged him up a little bit. Also, this race is going to be different because back in 2016, the attention for Democrats was how do we pick up seats around the state, because they thought Trump was going to implode. Trump did it, however, led a kind of a rural wave that helped make this race close. Jennifer Schilling is not going to make that mistake again. She'll be focused on her own seat because her seat could be the one that prevents Republicans from getting to a two-thirds majority in the Senate, because you look at Patty Schottner in Somerset, very difficult path to re-election because it's a very Trump seat. Dave Hansen's retiring that seat in Green Bay, a GOP leading seat. You're talking, I have an incumbent there, makes it more difficult. Republicans need three seats, to net three seats in both houses to two-thirds majority, which negates the Evers veto. Schilling's seat could be the one that stops that from happening, so he's going to be paying attention to a race this fall.
You only got 15 seconds left for falling.
Hmong community, President Trump's looking at deporting members of Hmong community from this country who have not become citizens, they've committed a crime. We have a decent-sized Hmong population in Wisconsin. Their future is under threat right now.
Okay, and I'm the wonk. I looked up. 2010 census, Wisconsin had 49,200 Hmong citizens. One-third of all Asians in Wisconsin were Hmong. And next week, we should book a show, maybe an hour. We have we have very long assembly meetings, and then we have a primary, but okay, we'll confine it to a half hour. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for February 14th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.